Hey, what's going on, guys? Welcome to Greek Gossip, episode 13. My name is Dell. I'm here with my awesome co-host, OG gangster, one of a kind, Julie. What's going on?
Not too much. Tuesday evening. Not quite fall weather here in Austin quite yet, but perhaps in a couple weeks when we have the U.S. Grand Prix, it may be. Do you want to tell all of our fans and listeners the update on our attendance to the race?
Oh yeah, don't make it a big deal. Like, you knew I was going the whole time. I played it down, but we're booked. We will be at the event live. You might be going Friday. I'm getting in Friday night, so we'll be doing Saturday, Sunday for sure. Maybe we broadcast some snippets.
Yeah, we can do some Instagram lives.
Yeah, exactly. So we're locked and loaded, so we'll be there.
Very exciting.
Yeah, that would be pretty suspect if we didn't go. So we're locked and loaded.
Yep. I think I finally landed on my clothing dilemma for the weekend. I wasn't sure which team, which drivers I felt like supporting, but I think right now my plan is to wear a Lando hat on Saturday and a Max shirt on Sunday. And I'm feeling pretty good about these two decisions. I can't commit to a team jacket at this point in time. I'm not like prepared to make that decision.
Yeah. So for the listeners, we were having this text conversation about just general merch. You know, there's some pretty fire jackets. I think we were talking about the McLean like rain jacket essentially. And the point I was making is like you can like follow a couple racers, you can root for a couple different teams. Like, I think that's kosher, but once you make the investment in a team jacket, that's your team.
I know. That's but like team. My team, I feel like, is Ferrari, but I'm just like,
you're super
not
undecided.
Feeling spiced up from them right now.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you need to just chill. Wait till beginning of next season and then just make the commitment.
Recommit to a team.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So yep. I have the Mercedes team jacket. So even though the McLaren one is so fire,
they have the best merch. Although their online store is not working for me today and I'm unable to purchase the hat I want. So
yeah.
Very frustrating.
I have a feeling I'll probably pick up some McLaren merch, not the jacket, because I've got the Mercedes jacket, so I'll have to hang tight on that. But maybe like a shirt or like a zip up or sweater or something like that. But the full rain jacket, I can't do it again.
Yeah.
So,
but I'm pretty pumped.
So if it rains, you'll find me in the all black Mercedes joint. But I thought it was funny how intensely you were taking the what to wear. It's like we were going to a club or something like that.
Very stressed about it.
I was like,
I ordered the Max shirt.
Yeah, the Max merch is tough because they just pepper Red Bull stuff.
It's so terrible. It's so bad. I ended up just getting this navy blue t-shirt that has his number on it and his name because the bright orange is just like a little much for me. I'm not sure. So I feel good about the decision I made, but the Red Bull team just does not have the same quality of merch as, I mean, McLaren's merch is nice. Like, they have so much stuff. Red Bull's is terrible. And then they also have like Sergio and Max modeling it, and neither of them are clothing models, so it just like kind of makes it even worse.
Yeah. See, that's where Mercedes, when they leverage Lewis, you're like, okay, Lewis actually pulls it off fairly well.
Yeah.
So anyways, I think we ordered some Grid Gossip shirts. So if you're at the U.S. Grand Prix and you happen to see four folks wearing light heather Grid Gossip shirts, it's a good chance that's us. Come find us. We'll be giving out
some stickers coming.
Some stickers, yeah. And those stickers, you'll have to wait for it, but they will have some real value, trust me. So more on that coming up in the next few weeks. But yeah, looking forward to it. Excited that we locked that down. And it's a go.
Indeed. Well, there was no race this weekend. The only thing I want to talk about in off-grid gossip news was a lot of the drivers. So I think it was George and
Stroll.
Yes. George Stroll and the Red Bull. No, the coach guy.
Oh, yeah. Horner was there. That's true.
Yes, with Ginger Spice. They were all at the James Bond premiere. I thought it was interesting Lewis wasn't there.
Yeah, Lewis.
He's like Sir Lewis.
Yeah, he went
and
the
Royals were there.
Well, he went to Paris and he was hanging out with Neymar and Mbappe from PSG. He seemed to be pretty active during the off week. I also have another theory. I'm just going to put this out there. These guys, well, Max not so much, but Lewis has been traveling quite a bit and interacting with lots of different people.
You think he's going to get COVID again?
I think that F1 has just told him and Max, like, listen, we're going to quote unquote test you, but we're not going to test the results. Like, because think about it. Think about, like, Max came down with COVID right now and couldn't race. Like,
he's much more like,
that would blow.
I like to stay at home with my girlfriend. It was his birthday. So they were kind of on a yacht in Monaco, it looked like, for that.
Yeah, I'm just saying it seems like Lewis is definitely risking getting the COVID just being out there. But I think F1 just told him, listen, there's so much money on the line, like as far as ratings go. Don't worry about COVID. You guys are good for all the races. They must have told them that because they can't. I
don't know.
You can't just, hey, Lewis or Max tested positive for COVID, so they're not racing. That would just be like.
It would be wild, terrible. But would make things more interesting.
No, it wouldn't. Not even slightly. The championship would be over. What would make it interesting, these guys racing head-to-head for the next 7 races. So hopefully that happens. But yeah, I was thinking about that. Like, Lewis is traveling. He's hanging out with soccer players and all kinds of different people. Like, he must not be overly concerned. So hopefully that doesn't happen.
Well, moving on into our review and commentary about the Shoemaker documentary. We first start the documentary with his first entrance into Formula One. This was in 1991 at Spa, Belgium, where he continued to create buzz when in qualifying, where he finished 7th. And then the week after, he signed a contract for the following season with Team Benetton. I literally didn't even know these teams ever existed. Like a t-shirt company? And then what is Team Jordan?
Well, it's not Michael Jordan.
I figured it wasn't Michael Jordan.
So this is where I think, you know, full transparency. Did I know who Michael Schumacher was before I became an F1 fan? Of course. Like, I think everyone knew who Michael Schumacher was. But I didn't really know his early story at all. And so I think for anyone that's recently started following the sport, like I have in the last 3-4 years, honestly, I just thought Michael Schumacher came for money and had worked his way up racing F3, F2, although it was called something different at the time, and just got called up because he was the best guy not in a Formula One car. So to find out that he, you know, was this amazing go-karter using like the shittiest equipment and still beating everybody. I think he was doing some other racing outside of like Formula One for maybe it was Mercedes, but I think it was Mercedes because they're a German brand, right? That was shocking to me. I had no idea he came up poor, kind of very Lewis Hamilton type story. So for me, right out of the gates for the documentary, I was blown away. And again, I guess most people that have followed the sport a long time knew that. I didn't. So like right out of the gates on this documentary, I was like super hooked.
Yeah, exactly. So he grew up in Germany and his dad ended up purchasing kind of like the go-kart arena there. And he helped his dad work on and test go-karts. There was a quote that was interesting, which definitely played out throughout his career, but it was, "I was always glad to have won with the worst and not the best equipment. Having to really fight like that was an additional motivation for me," which clearly just is like a foreshadowing of his time in Ferrari, which we'll get into in a bit. But he never imagined making it to Formula One for financial reasons alone, and then got signed by Team Benetton. And in 1992 in Spa, so kind of a year later, was his first win, and he was the youngest Grand Prix winner at the time at age 23.
Super impressive. I did you catch the part where they're at like the go-kart track and they're showing footage of like this guy kicking off like an interview and there's a kid on all fours with, like, I think it was a German flag or some sort of flag over his head. So he was serving as, like, basically a table.
I did not see that.
Go back and watch it. It's, I mean, that would never fly in today's age, but it was so funny for anyone that caught that. But yeah, I mean, like I said, it's super impressive. I just assume Schumacher came from money or, you know, had the pedigree of, you know, my dad was a driver or whatnot. So that was kind of mind blowing to me. And yeah, they did. I'm sure there's more to the story, but they did make it sound like it was complete chance that he got picked up and plugged in for Jordan. Although it seems like some of the key players knew of him clearly. So, you know, he made the most of his opportunity.
It was very clear even early on that he didn't really like the press nor the hype around him. He just wanted to compete and have as much of a normal life as possible. The dominant driver in Formula One at the time was Senna. Everyone looked up to him. He was super quick, competitive, and aggressive. And the two of them first came to a head in, and I'm going to butcher this, Magny-Cours, France, in 1992. So his first kind of season with Benetton. Schumacher was, did I just say that correctly? Look at me. Schumacher was behind Senna and he kind of hit him and Senna went out of the race and Schumacher was able to continue. This ended up causing a lot of friction. You kind of see the scenes of Senna kind of confronting him after the race, telling him to, like, you know, you have to be a little bit more careful. He's driving a bit aggressively. And you can definitely tell, like, in part, Senna was feeling threatened by the new talent coming on board.
Yeah, that video clip of Senna talking to Schumacher after the race, and he walks right up to him. He's got his hand on his shoulder and he's just basically, let's be honest, he's talking at him like he's his dad. I mean, I was pretty impressed with his ability to not just punch Senna square in the face. Because you try that in 2021, I mean, that hand would not be on the shoulder very long. I don't know. I wanted to punch Senna through the TV. I was getting so irritated. This documentary was mind-blowing for me because, one, I'm not a historian in F1. I never said I have been, never will act like I am. And again, I knew who Schumacher was, but I had no idea that his level of rivalry with Senna early in his career, I didn't even know that was a thing. Like, we'll get into it later, but when Senna crashes, I had no idea that Michael Schumacher was right behind him. Like, so to see that play out and to see that level of confrontation early, because Senna was, like, untouchable, right? So who's this young gun, you know, that's driving so aggressively or so competitively, if you will, with him? It's kind of the same thing you see with, like, Lewis and Max. So it resonates with me. You know, I think all of these drivers are very competitive. So to see that in the documentary and to think about what's happening currently, it's like, okay, I can see the shift in power, the shift of the new generation, because we're seeing the same thing right now, you know. So I get it. It was a different time back then.
Tale as old as time.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yep. So they didn't really cover anything in 1993, but in 1994 is when, you know, Schumacher was doing really well. They were winning races. They were in the running for the championship. And at Imola, you know, Senna knew he had to win in order to close the gap against Michael in the championship. He was staying ahead of Schumacher, but ultimately runs into the barrier. You know, so Schumacher was kind of following behind Senna. Senna was fighting to stay in the lead and ultimately runs into the barrier. Half the car was seemingly gone. It was a red flag for the race. He was helicoptered to the hospital. They restarted the race without, you know, anyone really knowing the severity of Senna's injuries. Schumacher ultimately won and finds out kind of after the race when they're going up to do the trophy ceremony that he's not in good shape. He's in a coma. There was a lot of misinformation given about whether Senna was dead or in a coma. Schumacher was definitely facing a lot of denial when ultimately he did pass away from that crash.
There's a lot going on there, so maybe we should unpack that. First and foremost, it's Imola. I know that for a fact. I think you pronounced the last one correctly, but it's Imola. That's an easy one. So I've watched the Senna documentary, the Senna movie.
I don't know. I didn't know there's a movie.
Yeah, it's really good.
Netflix?
No, it might be. I think this one was, I had to dig it up on like Prime or Apple or something like that, but okay. It's out there. I'll send it to you. Anyways, so obviously I knew about the crash and in that story. Geez, I don't know if in that documentary they even mention Schumacher and what was going on at the time. So again, this was new for me. So let's talk about like them restarting the race. Back then, there was, even with like football, right? So we've learned about concussion syndromes and post-concussion syndromes and how it affects the brain and health and yada, yada, yada. You know, back in the day around the same time in football, these guys would go helmet to helmet, play with concussions. There was no concussion protocol. It was just, that's what you did, right? So watching this, I think it's easy for someone to watch this and say, oh my God, they started the race. Like, how could they? The guy was helicoptered out. In today's day and age, yeah, that race doesn't restart, right? Pretty much all agree that would happen, right, today. But back then, that wasn't the culture, right? The culture was you compete and they're going to be okay and, you know, show toughness. And so watching them restart the race and kind of explain why, hey, he's going to be fine, you know, he'll probably be at the next race. I totally understood that because my dad was a football player, coached football. So I kind of grew up in that same kind of like toughness. You don't miss a play, you don't miss a game, they're going to be fine for the next game kind of attitude. So that made sense. I don't know if you felt that way, but
yeah, I
mean, some people being disturbed.
It's more so just alarming throughout the whole documentary, like seeing them in these cars that didn't have the halo and just being like, wow, they are so exposed if they were to crash or something were to hit them. Like, that was just what's more alarming to me than anything. But I mean, there wasn't even probably cell phones in then. So I understand why there'd be a lot of like misinformation trying to figure out like, is he okay? Is he not? And seemingly he left the track alive. So, you know, they kept the race and they thought he would pull through. But they did mention, or, you know, when Schumacher was being interviewed, that he kept thinking of like after that race in subsequent races was, you know, all of the different turns. He's like, I could die at this corner, I could run into that barrier and die. And so it definitely left a lasting impression on him. But now that Senna had passed away in the 1994 championship, Damon Hill and Williams is now his main competitor. But the championship between the two came down to the last race. It was a 1-point difference in Adelaide. This is kind of where like the theme starts to come out of like Schumacher kind of like taking things a little bit too far and perhaps knocking out his competitors by like bumping or crashing into them a little bit.
Yeah. Who's that remind you of though?
I know. That is what's so crazy to me.
You know, it's interesting, right? I mean, we're sort of seeing this, you know, with Max and Lewis. I don't know if they're doing it on purpose. You never know if Schumacher was doing it on purpose. But, you know, you and I have talked about this. Like, I really hope that these guys are tied this year going into the last race, because if they both DNF, I guess theoretically Max could win because he has more first place. But like, you never want to see someone just blatantly take someone else out because they don't want to lose it. And so, yeah. You know, but again, I mean, you never know, right? Like, I don't believe Schumacher admitted he did it on purpose, right?
No, although, but Damon definitely felt like Schumacher did it on purpose. So we kind of then skip forward a couple of years, and he ultimately moves to the Ferrari team. This is where that quote that I mentioned earlier kind of like comes into play. Like, he was winning. It wasn't really motivating him anymore to stay on Team Benetton. And so he moved to Ferrari, which was not a good team at the time. And so Michael was really seen as a star from them. In that first year, the car was basically trash.
Two things here, and one kind of going back to your earlier point. The no halo, I can totally understand. And I don't want to miss this point, because I think as each generation comes along, there's always this like argument of like, who's the GOAT, right? You're seeing it nowadays with like, who's the GOAT, LeBron James or Michael Jordan? And I'm like, Michael Jordan is not even close, right? But the new generation will argue it's, you know, it's LeBron James, right? So there are people that say Lewis Hamilton's a GOAT, right? He's the GOAT. He's the best racer. It's not even close. And I would say the same thing too, right? Because it's like, well, I haven't watched, but watching Schumacher with no halo do some of the things he was doing, wild. especially in the rain, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a little bit. I mean, absolute savage. There's no doubt that he's a GOAT, because to go through what he went through, the Senna situation, and continue being that dominant and that driven, for sure takes a GOAT for me. But anyways, to your point about Ferrari, again, blown away that Ferrari sucked. I thought Ferrari was always like a top team. I had no idea they were that bad when Schumacher joined them. And the other thing that I thought was interesting too was that it was Niki Lauda that basically sold him on taking that challenge on.
Yep.
He also did the same thing with Lewis joining Mercedes when he left McLaren. So I found that to be pretty neat.
Definitely. And he ultimately, in that first season at Ferrari, finally provided some results in the Barcelona race. It was rainy, which I guess he has a lot of experience with from go-karting. And so I think he ultimately won that race, which was the first one for Ferrari in a long time. And then in 1997 season, the showdown was between Schumacher and Villeneuve, who was on Williams. And this is where Michael gets into some more trouble with his crashing. So Schumacher crashes into Villeneuve. And I mean, you can see that, like, Michael thought that Villeneuve hit him. He was absolutely convinced. He got out of his car, was looking back on the track like, I cannot believe he hit him. Once he saw the video, he realized it wasn't the case, and that he kind of overstepped the mark when he didn't need to, which is something he often did. But they disqualified him from the world championship, which was something that had never happened before in the sport. It seemed like definitely like a steep punishment for that crash.
I was kind of floored, because that's a very, very severe punishment. I think it's Villanueva, but that's neither here nor there. Yeah, I mean, I think this served him well, though, because obviously as we get into the next few years, he goes on a run. But to your point, and I think that he admitted this in the documentary, he realized he didn't need to make that move. You know what I mean? So yeah. I could appreciate that, right? I mean, we don't see that as often nowadays. You know, you still got Max and Lewis saying, no, that move was totally fine. Like, they should, like, so it's nice to see these really good drivers say, you know what? And I don't know if he did it real time when this race occurred, but to admit fault and grow from it, that says a lot.
But did he grow? Because we have another incident in 1998. So after he got disqualified, him and his family like went to a chalet in Norway, which looked absolutely freezing. In 1998, he kind of put a lot of effort in with the Ferrari mechanics into the car. And in that season of 1998, his big competitor was McLaren. They had a really good car that year. The driver was Mika Häkkinen.
Mika.
And they were racing for the championship throughout the season. There was at one point, you know, Mika confronted Michael that he needs to be more careful. So kind of like the same situation that Senna did before their incident together. And now we're back at Spa. Spa seems to be a theme of notable things happening in Schumacher's life. It was another rainy race. Michael hit Mika on the first lap.
Mika.
Which gave Michael the opportunity to earn points when Mika couldn't. And then Michael hit Courtland, lapping him. His front tire came off. They were kind of saying that, like,
Jesus, we're gonna sound this one out. Coulthard? I actually don't know that one.
David Coulthard. They were saying that he took his foot off the throttle and then basically hit. And then Schumacher hit him in that way. I'm gonna repeat this whole thing. So, okay, so Coulthard.
Jesus Christ. So basically, what happened was this guy was about to be lapped. It was raining cats and dogs. You couldn't see shit. and he decided to come off the throttle on the inside.
Yes.
Fucking Schumacher ran it right up his ass.
Exactly. And so now Michael's out. David's out. I'm not going to try to pronounce his last name because we're getting way too far down that rabbit hole. But what was interesting here was Michael stormed down the pit lane and went to Colt Coulthard. I have that written in there.
We're going
to
call this guy DC, okay? We're just going to go DC. He was ready to throw Bozo. Yeah, and I wish they would have let them fucking
go. He was ready
to
have it out. He was so angry. He went into the garage and goes, "Do you want to fucking kill me?" And Michael refused to take responsibility on the track. DC did accept responsibility of his part, but I do believe, you know, like both of them had a play in this. And Michael said he was never wrong. And so this is where I feel like he didn't learn his lesson from being disqualified in 1996.
Yeah, that one's tough for me because I don't know that circuit well enough. I don't know that circuit at all, honestly, and I can't tell you. Was that a Spa? It was a Spa, right? So yeah. I guess we have seen the circuit. But at that point in the circuit, in the track, I couldn't tell you if when you're getting lapped, you should be on the inside, which is where DC was, or you should be on the outside. What I do know is that it was dumping. Obviously, these F1 tires put up a lot of spray. Mm-hmm. And I could you know, totally make sense that could happen. Think Michael was pissed because he came off the throttle so hard. So by the time, I mean, you come off the throttle and you're going full speed in the other car, that car pops up out of nowhere, especially with the mist and the spray.
Yeah, they couldn't even see it was happening.
Yeah, and he may not have been on the right part of the track. I can't tell because Michael was taking that inside line. So my guess is DC was supposed to let him pass on the inside, which means he's supposed to be on the left side of the track. That's my guess. And yeah, if that is the case, I'd be fucking pissed too. And I want to throw some bows too. I wish they would have let them fight. Like that
was
that
wild.
Would have been...
That also would never happen now. Like they would stop somebody before they do that. I don't even feel like people are like out in the garage like that these days.
You've seen that in NASCAR a few times, but NASCAR is some other level shit. Yep. But NASCAR, I've seen that a few times.
So moving on into the 1999 season, people started to question whether Michael was really the right driver for a Ferrari because he still hadn't won the championship for him. At Silverstone, he ran into the barriers head first. Michael could kind of like barely get out of the car, finally gets out. And this is where kind of his wife is like, we never really thought he could ever get injured, which is just crazy to think that after he's been in part of so many accidents where he got out kind of harm free, but others didn't. So it's not like he had never been involved in an incident before, but clearly they thought that he was invincible.
Well, here's the thing though. I wasn't surprised by that because I literally just put myself in her shoes, not as like a wife, but just like we saw Grosjean go through a steel plate and his car split in half and he was on fire and he walked out of that.
Yeah.
We've seen, you know, just a couple of weeks ago, you know, car, literally a tire go over Lewis Hamilton's head. You know, we saw Max going. So like, honestly, when these guys crash really hard with the halo, I fully expect them to get out of the car and be okay too. And that's, you know, I get it. Like I totally get it. And this was, you know, you could say, how could you expect them to be okay? They never had the halo. You know, that was like so far in the future. That was never a thought of like they're driving without a halo. So I get that. I totally get it. Now, does that mean we sort of take these drivers for granted and think they never get hurt? Yep, that's true. We do. We don't mean to, but like it's so safe, right?
Yeah.
Back then it was still relatively so safe based on how fast they were going. So I do understand that. I do.
Yep. So he did not win the championship 1999. In 2000, the fight again was with Mika. In Monza, Michael wins. He closes the gap between him and Mika for the championship. And this is where he tied Senna's record of 41 wins. And in the post-race interviews, when they mentioned this, Michael was like visibly upset. Like he was moved to tears. And interviewers kind of wanted to keep on interviewing Mika. And Mika was like, we have to stop this interview. Like he's sobbing right next to me. So that was kind of compassionate to see amongst competitors. But in Suzuka, which I guess is in Japan. This was not a race that Michael had won in the past 3 years, and he delivered Ferrari the championship they had been waiting for 20 years. And after that, you know, he just mentioned like the pressure was off. He drove for fun. He didn't owe anything to anyone, and he was just kind of enjoying racing.
Yeah, you get the monkey off your back. I was blown away that Ferrari had actually had real conversations internally about maybe Michael not being the right driver. Like, I was always under the impression that when he went to Ferrari, they just started winning right away. So the fact that they struggled for the first couple of years was mind blowing. Mika, I don't know if we gloss over this, but Mika and Michael raced, they go-karted together, and they were like the top two guys, and they raced a shitload as kids. So they knew each other really well, and they knew each other's driving style really well. So it was pretty cool to see Mika in the documentary, because he looks relatively the same, which is pretty
has not aged.
Crazy. No, not at all. So good for him. But he seemed like a really good dude. So I could see myself being a big fan of his if I had followed during that time.
Yep. Moving on. Oh, there was one other thing that Seb was interviewed, and he said that Shoemaker was his hero, and that just warmed my soul, because he was like literally in the documentary for 10 seconds. Otherwise, he said nothing, but he was speaking German, which was also adorable. And he retired from, not Seb, but Shoemaker retired from racing at the end of this season. During his retirement, he did a shit ton of skydiving, like an extreme amount. Like, his wife was like, we would go skydiving and he would do it 24 times in one day. Does your brain just melt?
Yeah, I've done it once in my life and I was done for the rest of my life. I was like, oh, that's it. I'm good.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. Although Seb was only in the documentary, like, you know, literally 10 seconds, you kind of understand why Seb is so close with Mick and kind of acts as like a fatherly figure to him. Yeah. You know, and he's always going out to him after the races. Good job. And they're meeting in the garage. So
definitely
kind of cool how the things go full circle. And we'll get to that in a little bit. But
so he finally had a comeback. He felt like he didn't have much to prove. And so he just wanted to come back, drive and compete. And he joined the Mercedes team. But he felt really far away from his family. He didn't understand why he was really doing this when he had spent so much time away from them. Because at this point, he had Mick and Mick's sister. And so it wasn't as easy for them to kind of like travel around with him. They didn't really go into much detail about his time on Mercedes. The next thing that we kind of get to is the accident in Mirabel in 2013. You know, he had even said he recognized the snow wasn't optimal. And to your point, you know, considered going to Dubai to skydive, which is just so casual. Like, oh, I'm off in France, but, you know, maybe it's better to go to Dubai and skydive. And I think what was like most notable, we don't know terribly much about the accident and they didn't actually talk too much about it in the documentary, but, you know, the family almost speaks of him like he's dead. From what I've read online, they're essentially just kind of making him comfortable. They're keeping his family close. They're keeping everything really private, because to some of the comments about, you know, how Shoemaker wanted to live his life early on in his career, like, he was a very private person. So the family is honoring that for him now and just kind of doing whatever they can. They definitely speak of him very fondly. When Mick is being interviewed, he speaks how much he would love to have his dad, you know, with him right now while he's an F1 driver. But there's really not a lot of details around, you know, his condition, because they're keeping it, you know, super private. But when I first watched this documentary, I was like, oh, he's dead, just the way that they speak of him. But I think he's just so drastically different now that in some ways he probably does feel dead to them.
I would disagree. I don't think they feel like he is dead to them. I think, yes, there was a lot of past tense used. So that was kind of your first giveaway. And yeah, I mean, I knew I was pretty sure he was still alive. But yeah, you could get that impression if you were watching it for the first time and didn't know anything. So that was tough. The Mick thing, I think, broke everybody. I actually, I didn't cry. I know there was probably a lot of crying on your behalf and a lot of people that watched it. I personally felt a little selfish after wrapping up the documentary, especially after the Mick commentary about, you know, I wish I could just talk to my dad about, you know, driving, mm-hmm. you know, racing, because I was hoping they would, you know, like really give like a present day update or show some pictures or something like that. And then like afterwards I was like, no, dude, like, don't be a selfish asshole. You know what I mean? Yeah. So it is crazy that they've been able to keep it this private. It's impressive, but I mean, they gave a few tidbits here and there. You know, I think his lawyer said that like he can't walk, you know, his wife mentioned, you know, he's still there, but not the same person, which, you know, kind of makes you assume maybe he's, you know, he's not all there. You know what I mean? But yeah, it was definitely a bummer. But yeah, the Mick thing gave it away, you know, because honestly, I could tell you as early as the start of this year, I was always like, I wonder when like Michael's, they're going to have Michael in the garage. Like, that would be so cool. Now it makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. That really ends it. I thought it was a great documentary. I definitely learned a lot about Shoemaker, although I will still pronounce his name as such. Bad habits die hard.
I will say I think we all wish it was a little bit longer.
I wish it was a series, yeah.
Yeah, because now it's like, all right, and I'm sure, you know, through some Googling and things like that, you can learn more. But I would love to see whether it's just another documentary made by maybe, I think this one was backed by the family, obviously, since they did a lot of interviews. But just filling in some of the gaps, right? Because they covered certain sequences of his career, and, you know, it was only a hour and a half documentary and they got to a lot. But if you go through like the Senna one, they break down like every single year.
Oh really?
Yeah. And so this was a great documentary. I think it was fantastic. I would love to see them being Netflix or whoever come out with another one that really goes in depth, because I think for a new fan like myself who knew who Schumacher was but really didn't know his story in depth, it'd be cool now having a really strong baseline of information to go and get super nitty gritty on the details. You know what I mean?
Yep, definitely.
Yeah. Also, one other thing that we didn't really cover, but how gangster is his wife?
Yeah. I mean, she was like his number one supporter.
She was just really impressive. I mean, it's kind of sad to say, but like in today's day and age, like I would fully not expect, not her specifically, but the partner to stick around, you know, just with all the publicity and lack of privacy. Yeah, it can't be easy, but yeah, kudos to her. She seems like a champion.
Yep.
Very cool. Yeah, I thought it was a great documentary. Now I was kind of craving more. So we'll see if someone comes out with something else. But the fact that these guys drove with no halo is bananas. I also think the once they wrap up the movie, they do the onboard camera with him at Monaco. I thought that was fucking rad. So rad. We go to Turkey.
Gobble, gobble.
Turkey this week. And I just checked the weather forecast. It looks like rain. So that could be interesting. We're getting a lot of rain this year, I feel like.
I like it.
Yeah.
Keeps it interesting.
Yeah, it definitely does. So excited about that. And then we're U.S. after that, right?
Week off in the U.S. Grand Prix.
So excited about that. So we'll see who is leading the championship by the time we get to Austin.
Well, we'll be here next week.